I'm Christopher Lydon, at home with Gunter Schuller just outside Boston because there's nobody like him in music. He's the composer, conductor, horn virtuoso, jazz historian, and critic who had the nerve and the authority years ago to decree that all musics are created equal. He has walked that walk through a 70-year career between Beethoven and Bill Evans, between Igor Stravinsky and Charlie Parker, and he's talking that talk with us the same way. Old, new, jazz, and classical music, back and forth, intimately and equally, because, as he says, well, they're equal. Above a certain level, where genius changes the language of music, he says, it's all democracy. No matter what it's labeled, if something is perfect, well, then it's perfect. Gunter Schuller got started late, he feels, at age 11, without teachers, but with an uncanny gift for reading music. He learned by studying scores, listening to records, and then from the vibrations on the floor of the pit with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. He made it to the Met in the 1940s as a teenager on the French horn. Same horn he played with Miles Davis's Birth of the Cool Nonet in the 1950s. He revived the New England Conservatory in the 60s and 70s, and inside it, he revived ragtime jazz that became the soundtrack of the Robert Redford, Paul Newman blockbuster movie, The Sting. We're catching him on a workday afternoon. In his 89th year, Gunter Schuller has a dozen or more commissions for new pieces in his own atonal mode, and he's assembling a second volume of autobiography. The first volume, titled A Life in Pursuit of Music and Beauty, runs 600 pages through the 1950s in the New York of his boyhood, what he remembers as day and night, a cultural paradise of all the world.
And I say that because, first of all, by the end of the 30s, with all the programs that the New Deal had created for artists and musicians, and there was no materialism possible, so people turned onto themselves and they found things that they didn't know they could do. And these wonderful programs came along. So there was this indigenous growth of the music, and in classical music, particularly the Aaron Copland, you know, neoclassic group. But even greater than that, between, let's say, 1940 and after the war, we inherited all the people that Hitler sent us. they escaped, of course, and they enriched our culture even more than that. And, you know, whether it's Thomas Mann or Schoenberg or Stravinsky or you know, half the great directors in Hollywood were Germans or Viennese. Mm. Then a lot of the Europeans went back to their home countries. And then in the late 70s, 80s, that kind of New York disappeared completely. It's now a different New York. Mm. But I feasted on that in all the ways that I could. You mentioned some of it. I mean, we almost literally didn't sleep, my wife and I. It was so exciting and so much to see and hear. For example, a given day might be the following. I'm playing, let's say, Carmen at the opera in the afternoon. And in the evening, there's, of all things, one of the longest operas ever, Meistersinger, which lasts actually 4.5 hours. Mm. But they had made cuts in it, so it ended just a little bit after 12. And then my wife met me at the door, and then we walked up Broadway. And there we went to one of seven clubs that was just on Broadway, Royal Roost, Erlang most particularly, but the Aquarium. Duke Ellington played there all the time. Child's restaurant chain had jazz. I mean, it was just all over. Then there's 7th Avenue, which goes at an angle from Broadway. There was another seven clubs. And on the side streets, there was Boplicity, where everybody played. And then, if that wasn't enough, I could go to 52nd Street, where Billie Holiday was. So I'm telling you, we were both just so fanatically involved with this, which eventually is, you can describe it as learning and as growing from all of these influences. That and the other thing that we did so much, it's a little bit related, is that we spent, I don't know, for 3 years we spent altogether hundreds of hours at the Museum of Modern Art because they had just begun a whole history of the film starting with 1895. So every afternoon between my morning met rehearsal and the evening performance, we would spend 2 or 3 hours at and seeing a great Lubitsch film or something, you know.
But there was literally no time for sleep in that schedule, and it seemed to work fine with your constitution.
Well, it is true that I went on a regimen of only 4 hours a night. And I said to myself, this is how I came to that. That came rather early. When I was 18, my mother was telling me how you got to get 8 hours sleep every night, and the doctors all say so. Yeah, okay, I listened to that. And then I figured out, God damn it, if I sleep 8 hours every night, I'm going to piss away 1/3 of my life. No, I'm serious. My horn playing did not get worse. All my writing, all my activities. And I was just lucky that I was one of those persons who could actually live on 4 hours sleep. And I did that for then 50, 60 years of my professional life. And can you imagine how much I accomplished 2 hours earlier in the day and 2 hours at the end of every day? And I always felt well.
Gunther, this book covers so many individuals, so many jazz groups, so many orchestras. I don't know where to begin, but I'm reminded of a moment. You were conducting an orchestra, and I was just watching in rehearsal. You were conducting a Richard Strauss piece, and you said to the orchestra, all of them wonderful players, you said, I just want to remind you that Richard Strauss had more music in his head, in his body, in his whole being, in his soul, than all of us playing it here together. But among other things, I wanted to ask you, how many people can we talk about that had that kind of absolutely transcendent gift? There were a lot of them in your book, including Duke Ellington, most especially maybe. But you've got Charlie Parker in there for sure, John Lewis, Metropolis, Toscanini, Lawrence Brown. Pick out those stars of your life for whom you still bring, to me, a very wonderful awe, just plain awe.
Gosh, Chris, there's so many. You know, just in terms of all the music that I studied when I was young, you know, I began composing. I began getting into music very late, at age 11. Usually people start 6 or 7, play an instrument or piano or something. I started very late, and the first thing I wanted to be was a composer. So in all those years from 11 to 15, 16, and on from there, I collected a lot of records, and I listened to all the music on the recordings, and I followed with the score. So by the way, I never had a teacher. My teaching was scores and hearing the music and analyzing it and studying it that way. The other teacher was playing in a great orchestra because when I played for those 15 years in the Metropolitan Opera, I mean, it wasn't just, I by that time I knew that music. And you know, we're talking about Verdi, Wagner, Mozart, everything, great composers. I tell you, until you hear music inside of an orchestra, I could even feel the vibrations on the floor of the pit. I mean, that is an experience you cannot have any other way. In other words, to be surrounded by this world of music in such an intimate way. And I, of course, I almost hate to say this, many musicians had been there for many years, but they were pretty blasé about all this. But me, as a young composer, you know, exciting to learn, I just feasted on that too, you know. And I often had the score of the music while I was playing. So those were my two teachers. But then again, on the other side, at home, when I discovered some recordings that became very important in my life, one of them is composer named Frederick Delius. Most people don't know about him very much, but a great, great English composer. And he wrote in what is a post-Wagnerian chromatic style. And Sir Thomas Beecham had made, by the time I got around to buying records, 6 volumes of the music of Frederick Delius. And it is so beautiful, such beautiful music. There's one piece, it's on a poem by Walt Whitman, at the end of the piece, it is so moving that I have never conducted it without crying at the end of the piece. It's so overwhelming. You know, you can't cry. You can't fake a cry. Mm. Actors do, but you really can't. Another great conductor, Stokowski, he was the first to record a work by Alexander Scriabin. Mm. And this is the same kind of post-Wagnerian chromatic music which I grew up with, which was then still new music. And Scriabin got a hold of me. I tell you, for 3 or 4 months, I just immersed myself in his music, both the recordings and all the scores. I studied every piece he ever wrote. Mm. And my parents were worried about me because I just locked myself in my room and I didn't sleep, I didn't eat, I didn't do anything. They thought I was going mad. It was so deep. And of course, by then I had already absorbed Stravinsky, Debussy, Ravel, Mio, some of the more moderns, you know. So I just did all this studying. There's another reason why I didn't want to sleep very much.
It also reminds me of this extraordinary gift. I don't know anybody who has it the way you do. Liszt had it, but being able to go from the text to the sound back and forth interchangeably. You are famous for your transcriptions of a very hard to describe jazz solos.
Yeah,
that's part of your what, synesthesia or something?
Listen, by the way, it wasn't solos. What I was the first to do, and by the way, I started this at age 17 in Cincinnati, to transcribe from the recordings the whole performance.
Yes.
By the time I left Cincinnati, I had transcribed at least 10 pieces of Duke Ellington's. Mm. And every detail, what the drummer played, whatever was on that I could hear on that record. Because I wanted to, you see, my ears are very good still, and were very good. And I could, of course, hear it all, but I wanted to see what it looked like and compare it that way to my classical music, you see. And I became obsessed with that. Then I did another extraordinary thing. I hope nobody thinks I'm bragging here, but I say it in all humility because I was so amazed that I could do this. One of the great composers of the Second Viennese School, Alban Berg, a recording of his greatest work, perhaps, the Violin Concerto, came out while I was in Cincinnati. That blew my mind. I mean, these pieces all overwhelmed me, you know, for a while. And I said, my God, I'm going to buy the score. I want to see how can this happen. And I found out that the score was not available in the entire United States. What few copies had gotten to the United States before World War II had all been sold out. And here I am, and I can't even look at a score. And I said, God damn it, I'm going to do something. And so I copied from the recording the whole last 12-inch side, which was about 4.5 minutes of music. And I did not know what the instrumentation was. I didn't know whether there were two trombones or three. I didn't know how many oboes there were. But never mind, I put down all the notes that I could recognize. And this is now hardcore atonal music. And my girlfriend of that time, she became my wife, Marjorie, she said, you're crazy. And of course, again, I spent all nights doing that. And so this was all in my teaching and in my learning. I just have this, even to this voracious appetite for learning. I'm still a student. You know, I just, but transcribing an atonal piece, man, nobody has ever done that.
The other thing that's so peculiar about you, Gunther, is that you mastered these different musics in great depth. I mean, there are a lot of amateur listeners who love jazz and classical, but there you were walking across those streets every day of your life. What did it take to be able to see those very different kinds of traditions as equally gifted but equally important?
It's because they're equal. No, look. By the way, I didn't neglect Beethoven and Mozart and Bach and all of that. You know, I was not just studying the modern music. But, you find out as you do this, my God, here Beethoven learned from Mozart. Mm. And it's a step forward in the development of music. And then comes Schumann, and then comes Wagner. And then you find out, well, it's all great. You could argue about whether Schumann's music is not quite as great as Brahms's or something like that. And, you know, a lot of critics and people have all these opinions, but when they're above a certain high level that changed the language of music or have helped it grow, that's all democracy for me. That's all equal. It's even difficult to say, when you really dig deeply into this whole tradition, whether Beethoven is actually a greater composer than Mozart. And I'll tell you why. Because in the end, I think Beethoven was greater, but only in one respect, not in the actual writing of the music. He moved music 100 years ahead. Mozart did not do that. But if you look at the perfection of a Mozart piece and the perfection of a Beethoven piece, they come out equal. When I discovered Duke Ellington one night, next morning I was just overwhelmed by the sounds of the Ellington Orchestra. And next morning I told my father, in all seriousness, you know, Pop, you know, this Ellington music, my God, it's in the hands of such a great composer, it's just as good as Beethoven, classical music. And he nearly had a heart attack. But I still maintain that, because when something is perfect, as you've already mentioned, no matter what its label is, if something is perfect, well, then it's perfect. It might be totally different, just as jazz of Duke Ellington is totally different from Beethoven. Different instrumentation, different instruments, different ways of harmonizing and all of that. If it comes out on that higher top, then they go into the pantheon. And I think that's so beautiful that there can be this enormous pantheon stretching across the whole variety of styles and musical languages.
Yeah. Start anywhere, but with some of them surprising, people that you would put in that pantheon. Which ones would you kill to talk with again? Resume conversations, re-listen to their music live. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, I'd never known that you stayed up late many nights with Charlie Parker, and he told you things that he didn't tell other people.
Well, I'm not sure that he didn't tell. In fact, I know that he told something like this to other people. We didn't see each other an awful lot because most of the time he was in California and also in the hospital or whatever, you know, with his drug problems. We didn't see each other like I saw Miles Davis and John Lewis, you know, almost every day. But there was this occasion at the end, I'm getting ahead, at the end of his life. I think it must have been about 3 months before he died. You know, the Countess Koenigs, what's her name?
Koenigswasser or whatever.
Yeah. Something like that. She had this huge apartment near the United Nations building, and that was a hangout for musicians. And by the way, when you walked into those whatever number of rooms it was, man, you would get high just by being in there. I mean, God. And there wasn't very much furniture in half of that place. There were just mattresses on the floor. Hmm. And so all the musicians gathered there. You know, just as they wanted to. And she open house, you know. I mean, this is legendary. Everybody's written about that. Well, one night I went there. I wanted to meet somebody. I can't remember who. And I lay down on one of these mattresses, and I kind of held my nose and ears. And Bird comes along. Oh, hey, Charlie. And, you know, and he stayed and he lay down on the mattress near me. And we talked about things and bad and good in jazz and society and so on. These people, by the way, whether it's Dizzy Gillespie or Miles or Charlie Parker or Monk, they were so deep in thinking about social matters, and, you know, as well they might.
Tony Rollins, too.
Oh, right? My God. You know, Dizzy was seen as a clown so much. Well, boy, was he ever a serious person in all other ways. But anyway, we lay there for a while, and he said, you know, Gunther, I can't stand it anymore. And he started sort of, you know, I've played every kind of music I can play. I've played every kind of blues that I can play. I can't do it anymore because I know there's, I'm paraphrasing of it, I know there's out there this great other music and I so much want to learn it. I've heard, and he mentioned particularly Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, which he had heard by, I think John Lewis had told him to listen to it, you know, because John was doing the same kind of thing, like trying to get some musicians more enriched in the other language. And it was terrifying. He started almost crying. He said, I want to study with you. And I said, of course, of course. And then it never happened, A, because one time he said he was going to come. He never showed up. And another time, his saxophone was in a hawk shop. Yeah.
Pawn shop. Yeah,
pawn shop, yeah. And for some reason, again, he didn't come up. And then 3 months later, he died.
Duke Ellington's practically on every page, every one of your 600 pages. But you have special fixations, too, on Lawrence Brown, the trombone player. I always imagine he's playing your voice in those arrangements. It's a horn like your own. But you're also a Ben Webster guy to a fairly well. I mean, speak about some of them as these transcendent musical guys.
Well, the thing about Lawrence Brown was, he was a trombone, and as you've sort of implied, the trombone is very near to the French horn. It's the same range. And when I first, a lot of we might be talking about is luck, things that happen to me. And you know already from millions of interviews you've done, many, many artists and actors and all that, they say, by the way, we should mention, a lot of this is luck. Luck, in my case, just the sheer luck of being born in New York. Mm. But anyway, what happened is that I was fortunate to hear Duke Ellington 4 times in my 2 years in Cincinnati. Mm. This was such a rich orchestra, and the colors of that orchestra, this 16-piece orchestra, had absolutely as much color, variety, timbre, as any symphony orchestra, or at least almost close to that. So that, as a composer who's very much into the color of the instruments, yeah, you know, the oboe color is different from a flute and clarinet. Even there's a difference between trombone and horn to some extent. That is one of the things that I have by heritage or something, the love of musical colors. So here was this 16-piece group and, you know, doing all these incredible things. And he had the ear and the genius to exploit that to the fullest.
Am I wrong that you love Ben Webster in a particular way?
Well, yes, he had another one of these totally individual styles, at least by the time he came around to Ellington in his early days. He was a Coleman Hawkins follower, and of course he had an enormous technique. But he turned in his later years, including that fabulous period with Ellington, into a lyric player and a ballad player. And, I mean, his music is so, how shall I put it, it's so deeply moving. It's almost certainly sensual, and it might even be sexual for all I know. I'm telling you, the way he moves into notes, this subtle coloring and sliding, It's so rich in warmth. And both Larry Brown and Ben Webster, and I could name probably, if my memory didn't fail me, 20 others who were really lyric players. That is something that had to be in jazz. And Ellington was the one who really did that. Nowadays, ballad playing is way down. Everybody plays highly technical stuff, you know, 30-second notes running around, you know. And because that was the width and breadth of Ellington. And any great composer, that they can go from the harshest, most exciting dramatic music to the simplest soulful music. And so many orchestras didn't have that range, you know, not to the extent of Ellington.
You write about the kind of overwhelming effect of hearing Lester Young at a particular moment, and he was surrounded with great players, including Billie Holiday and others, but there was something that just, I don't know, took your breath away.
That was that famous broadcast that, which was the last great program on television in jazz, where somebody got all these great musicians together, and about four or five, or six or seven different groups, and some added people. And the thing that I was referring to, particularly in that television film, was that Lester and Billy, they hadn't seen each other for a while. And I kind of feel they were in love with each other. Lester was so in such bad shape at that time that the producer had begun to decide, you know, we can't have him perform. He can't do it. But then they had a meeting amongst the musicians, and they finally said, no, listen, we cannot do this program without Lester Young. So even whatever happens. And so then he played, and he played only 12 bars. I'm gonna choke up now. And Billy sang it 1,000 times. And she stood there about 10 feet away from him, looking at him. And I mean, if you ever saw love expressed on a film and in this music, that was that moment.
So many of these names mean everything. I saw you, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago, we were crossing in a big ballroom or something, and you said, by the way, nobody has ever appreciated Errol Garner for the complete, you know, out-of-this-world genius that he was. And he was sort of my gateway drug. I mean, Concert by the Sea just took all of my brothers and sisters by storm.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Errol.
Well, it's so tragic that he has been virtually forgotten. And what he had, there's several things he no one else ever had. First of all, it is really sort of, in a sense, the high capacity of real swing. I mean, you could not sit still. It's like Basie. You can't not do something with your fingers or your feet or something. But he had that just on the piano. And of course, and then he had only a bass, who played a very modest secondary role. But the thing that ultimately just killed me, and I still don't understand how he could do that. All the pianists, before and after, have played the piano by the right hand and the left hand being sort of vertically coordinated.
Yes.
Which means that if you have bar lines in music, yeah, they would all, you know, things would organize, and what you do in the middle of the bar can be a little bit, you know, controversial. The things that he played with his right hand against his bass going dum dum bum bum, doing the harmony, you know, and this was unshakable. This was like a rock. And then, you know, it could be 13 and 2/3 or 9 and 19/17. I mean, one would have to transcribe this stuff with a computer, because there's no way a human ear could take those. And again, I say he just did this. And he took a tune and moved the melody with all five fingers, you know, going around with never losing the song, the flow of the song, you know, and it sounded absolutely correct.
Isn't it a little bit like the Brahms, the famous Brahms 3-on-2 rhythms?
Yeah, but that's so simple. 3 against 2 ain't nothing.
Speak of a few more names. Bill Evans, a guy that lingers in the piano world.
Oh my goodness, yes. Gosh, he's so high up there, I almost am speechless. He was such a modern-oriented by nature, again, a little bit without really knowing how or why. Mm. And every time I worked him, I hired him many times for some of the recordings I made with Atlantic Records, you know, through John Lewis. He would just play everything down. He could read anything, including one of the maybe the most demanding quasi jazz piece that was ever written, which is the piece called All Set by Milton Babbitt, this very avant-garde composer. Mm-hmm. And that was I commissioned that to be done at a concert in Brandeis University, which is legendary now, that concert. But anyway, it's incredibly complex, atonal, sort of 12-tone music, and many of the musicians, they struggled with this. Art Farmer, I forget who they all were. They just couldn't. It took months and months for them to learn to play this piece. Bill Evans sight-read it. And then the other thing, he was so much interested in the advancing of the harmonic language, yes, which he did. And there is this thing in my autobiography where I suggested to him, because he had mentioned something about Wagner, that he should come to my house every week and we would play through Wagner operas. And he did. He missed very few moments, even though he was pretty high on drugs. He was a little shaky. But anyway, and we sat forehands at the piano, and I played the lower part. And he was, of course, a wonderful. I mean, his hands, he could read anything. So we played through all the late, particularly late operas, Parsifal and the Ring operas. That's in itself, it's almost unbelievable. I've had many people tell me, Gunther, you made that up. You know, but that's how he was. It finally broke off. There was then a moment when he never showed up again. Mm. But that went on for almost a year. I think it was every Wednesday. Yeah, and he was such a dear man and so on. I felt bad for him. And in fact, after this episode, about a half a year later, he started to come to my house. He already knew where I lived, and he came up in the elevator. And he asked for money so he could get some drugs. And I don't know whether it was good or it was very bad and stupid. I gave him some money for, you know, whatever he needed for about a half a year. But after a while, I can't keep this on. And yet he played. He then learned to control it, as so many of them, you know, who were on various things. that they found a way of controlling the so they could still function fully, you know. And of course, everybody thought if you get high, you're going to play better. Well, let's see. And he had it very bad for a while. But then he saved himself by somehow, I don't know how they control these things.
Yeah.
He never got off it completely, but...
That's the first of two podcasts from our conversation with Günter Schuller. From Frederick Delius to Errol Garner, in the democracy of transcendent musicians who have moved and marked Günter Schuller's career over the years. In the second round, we'll start back at the beginning with the composer Igor Stravinsky and the piece, The Rite of Spring from 1913, that Günter says determined him and many more to become composers. Mary McGrath produced and recorded our conversation with Günter Schuller. Kunal Jasti edited it. If the life or the musics here resonated with you, we ask you to add your own joyful noise in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.